I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, a sweeping new biography of William F. Buckley Jr. argues that the witty political writer did more than popularize conservatism. He organized it into a durable political force that would reshape America from the Cold War to the Reagan era to today with Donald Trump. In Buckley, The Life and Revolution That Changed America, journalist and biographer Sam Tannenhaus chronicles how Buckley used his wit, charm, and pen to forge what became the modern conservative movement. Buckley defended McCarthyism, segregation, the war in Vietnam, denying the vote to African Americans as he defined conservatism. What is his legacy today? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
The value of trustworthy journalism has never been greater. TPR remains dedicated to delivering real, reliable, trustworthy news. We are proud to be here for you, and today, we need you to be here for us. Without federal funding to help shoulder the costs, your support is essential on the road ahead, and we're counting on you. Visit tpr.org to make your end-of-year gift today.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Well, I'm not too sure how many people today recognize the name William F. Buckley Jr., but when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, he was a master of all media. His PBS program, Firing Line, was on every week in my house. His newspaper columns were widely read. His magazine, National Review, it set the table for many political debates. After Barry Goldwater's defeat to Lyndon Johnson in 1964's presidential election, it was Buckley that kept the flame of conservatism burning until Ronald Reagan's election in 1980. And now that flame has engulfed America as conservatism has conquered the nation. Sam Tannenhaus has written a dynamic new biography of William F. Buckley Jr., Buckley, The Life and Revolution That Changed America. And Sam Tannenhaus, welcome to The Source.
Oh, great to be here.
There's a lot to cover, but I want to get into Buckley's roots in South Texas. You know, people would be astonished to find out about that. Talk about that.
Oh, it's just about my favorite part of the story. And I wish I could have written more about it. In fact, I did write far more about it and couldn't include it all. But I'll give you the highlights. His father, John Buckley, his father, William F. Buckley Sr., was born in San Diego, Texas. And your listeners will know that's not so far from San Antonio. There were Buckleys still in South Texas. And William F. Buckley Sr., that is the father of my subject, was born there in 1881. And his father, that is Bill Buckley's grandfather, was Sheriff John Buckley of Duval County. And this was in the period just before the famous Dukes of Duval, the Parr father and son, ruled that part of the world, you know, with a powerful political machine. And Buckley's grandfather, Sheriff John Buckley, was actually a reformer, a reform Republican in that era when politics was undergoing this sort of shift from the Democratic machine politicians to a new kind of progressive Republican Party. And that is where Bill Buckley's father grew up with his siblings. They went to a Catholic church. They were immigrants from Ireland via Canada. They traveled from Canada down to South Texas in the 1870s and then 1880 when Buckley's father was born there. They were very much involved in politics there. His father had also been a land surveyor. And so he got from that job to being the mayor, the sheriff of Duval County. And at a time, and some of your listeners will know, when there were border skirmishes with Mexican irredentists and insurgents. Because they were Catholic, they worshipped in the local Catholic church alongside Tejanos. So Buckley's father and his relations, you know, Buckley had several aunts as well, two aunts, all grew up speaking Spanish, as did William F. Buckley and his nine siblings, because when the father made and lost his first fortune in Mexican oil, then made his second in Venezuela, second fortune, place we're hearing about, particularly in connection with oil, the Buckleys moved to the Northeast. And so they're remembered today as a kind of patrician New England family. They were not. They were Irish Catholic from South Texas. And because they worshiped alongside the other Catholics in an area 80 to 90% Mexican American, all the Buckleys were fluent Spanish speakers. And I'll give you an example of that. Then you can actually get a word in edgewise. When I did an event in New York just a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was a month ago now, I've done so many of them, a woman came up to me who had met Buckley. She was from Madrid, born and raised in Madrid. And so, and she had met Buckley years ago, because Buckley knew everybody, as you said. He was one of the most famous men in America, probably the most famous public intellectual of his time. And I said, somebody told me Bill Buckley did not really speak fluent Spanish. And she said, that's true. He didn't speak fluent Spanish. He spoke perfect Spanish. You would not know he wasn't not from Mexico, from Spain, because they were raised in a kind of high Catholic counter-Reformation Spanish aristocratic family. It was really quite remarkable. But it began down there in Duval County now 140 years ago.
Do you think any of that that sand from the Wild Horse Desert of Duval County, that rubbed off and somehow informed his conservatism?
He kept guns in his desk till the day he died. Yeah, you know, his grandfather was famous for not wearing a holster. And you can see accounts, by the way. If any of your listeners are fans of newspapers.com, as I suspect you are, most journalists are, you will see stories on Sheriff Buckley arresting cattle thieves and rustlers and very proudly not wearing a gun because he wanted to restore order. So this idea of the frontier justice, is something the Buckleys took over. It's a combination of order and belief in law on the one hand, but on the other, you've got to deal with, you can't see my air quotes, the dangerous criminal element. And that means being tough. So it's that combination, a very aggressive kind of even militant approach to your adversaries, while at the same time you think you hope to be serving a higher sense of justice, reinforced, by the way, by Buckley's grandfather, whose first mentor was the priest in the local church, who was from Martinique and educated by Jesuits, very learned man. So the Buckleys have this combination. You know, Texans know this, but in an outside world where people are very, especially where I live in the Northeast, people have very provincial views of the heartland. And so they think, oh, people from Texas, they're all cowboys. And of course, they're not. Extremely learned. The long ties to the missionary tradition. One of Buckley's aunts, I discovered, Buckley didn't even know this, wrote important scholarly works on Catholic missionaries in South Texas, going back to the 17th century.
And also Buckley had spent time in the military in San Antonio?
Yes, he did. He was drafted World War II. He was born in 1925. So at the age of 20, he was inducted into the Army, had to postpone going to college at Yale University, where he became a very famous and influential figure, even while young. But yes, was inducted into the infantry and never made it overseas, but went to officers' candidate school. And then his final posting was in San Antonio, and where he supervised the demobilization, the demobbing of returning veterans. And he told me that was a really important experience for him, because he'd been raised, after all the money his father made in oil, been raised a great wealth, a 47-acre estate in Northwest Connecticut, this magnificent home, which you can still see, it's still standing, in New England, and had gone to prep schools and was raised with servants and tutors and all the rest.
And so he had an opportunity to rough it up a little bit. We're going
to
take
and to command be in command. Yes, to tell other guys his age what they had to do and to make it stick.
We're going to take a break here. It's a 1 minute break. We're going to continue our conversation about William F. Buckley Jr. We're going to move on from his time in South Texas and get into when he became the conservative's conservative. That you can call in 833-877-8255.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to helping Texas communities and emphasizing safety. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A new, sweeping, dynamic biography of William F. Buckley Jr. has recently been released. Buckley was the witty political writer, editor. He created modern American conservatism, which basically runs the show in America today. The biography is Buckley, The Life and Revolution That Changed America. And so, you know, Sam Tannenhaus is the author. And so, Sam, talk about Buckley in terms of, like, why do people today, do they turn to him as someone, as a guiding light, as a North Star for what conservatism should be, or does he seem like his time has come and gone?
No, they were looking to him again now because of the events. I felt this very immediately as the author of this biography, after the events of September 10th, when Charlie Kirk was killed, was murdered. Suddenly, the conservative movement, bereft of a leader, of a kind of intellectual leader, didn't know which way to turn. And conservatives began to go after one another. You know, there was a kind of internal, and it still remains now with the incursion in Venezuela. The conservative movement isn't always quite sure what it stands for. What Buckley was brilliant at, really unmatched before or since, was at bringing all the factions together. And it was partly because he combined these different attributes in his own upbringing, coming from Texas, raised in Connecticut. His mother was from New Orleans, being an aristocrat on the one hand and a Catholic on the other, a devout churchgoer, an intellectual and writer, but also an activist. He brought all these different components together so people could look to him. If Bill Buckley said you were part of the movement, then you were. And others accepted his intellectual guidance. You'd be surprised from how many people I hear from now, left and right, asking me questions about that. What would Buckley say? What would he think? What would he recommend?
He also policed the border of conservatism, particularly he got there eventually by trying to throw out the John Birch Society, people who were considered too fringy. He seemed like he was deliberately trying to package up conservatism. He was very much involved, you know, thinking about how do we influence America? How do we become mainstream? So in this idea, like his Robert Welch, you know, he had to go, although, you know, there were times where they were working together on things. But, you know, in his view of creating a conservative movement, he was thinking about creating a brand.
Yes. Well, you know, one important difference was when Buckley was leading the movement, when the movement was taking shape under his guidance, this is in the 1950s, the beginning of the Cold War, and liberal media was dominant. Nowadays, we have an entire ecosystem. In some sense, the creation of Bill Buckley in an alternative media world, right? And he did it really as a one-man band, as all the things you mentioned, the column, which was syndicated in more than 350 newspapers at a time when people got their news through the local paper. Buckley was syndicated all through the Texas press, the California press. So it was read everywhere. He had his magazine. He had his books. He wrote more than 50 books, fiction and nonfiction. And of course, television personality and firing line. He was doing that to create a space, we would now say, where conservative argument and could be presented to a liberal public. That's what's really different, is today we almost have parallel media universes. Tucker Carlson does not need to go on NPR, but Buckley did. Buckley was on PBS, as you said. He was living in a world where to be taken seriously, you had to be palatable and sensible and persuasive, above all, persuasive to a liberal audience. And that's what gave it a kind of ecumenical aspect, his conservatism, which we don't see so readily today. And in to some extent, and I found this in the many, many reviews of my book, which are interesting to read just to see how people react to Buckley. Not so much, maybe they can take or leave the book, that's up to them. But what they make of Buckley, and that is they see him as a forerunner, as someone who saw ahead of time how this kind of conversation, and that's, Buckley was brilliantly entertaining and funny and witty, how that kind of charming personality could win over big audiences. And that became the lesson passed down to President Reagan and his own way through President Trump.
He, I think about, you know, Marshall McLuhan's theories of media and the concept of cool media and on television as a successful way to be on television, and that he really seemed to fit that rather than coming across. He was combative. He loved, you know, the battle, but he did it in a way that was not hot. It was cool, and it was not adversarial. It was a civil dialogue. He would parry back and forth. He would clarify. He would provoke. He would concede a point, then pivot. You know, it was all very much engaging, which is what the theory of cool media is all about. And he was, that was, you know, you watch those, I watch them all the time on YouTube and just marvel at how masterful he was about presenting an argument. And in hindsight, we have today, you know, he's arguing things about race that you just are not, you know, don't hold up today, but he certainly sounds convincing.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up Marshall McLuhan, because one of Buckley's closest friends, the literary scholar Hugh Kenner, who's also a culture critic, had been a disciple of Marshall McLuhan. He'd studied with him. He'd known him at the University of Toronto. Kenner's famous scholar of James Joyce and the modernist writers. This shows you where the conservative movement was in that era, maybe compared to where it is today, because Kenner was a real force at National Review. And Kenner told Buckley early on, because he knew McLuhan's theories exactly as you've described them. And the one element we add to that, which is implicit in what you said, is that the audience participates. That's what the coolness is, that you're leaving room for the audience to react, and that reaction creates the dynamic of the true entertainment when you're dealing with the level of argument. That's what's so different about what we see today. The two heads, you know, squawk back and forth at each other, and they may wink a little bit to the audience. But in Buckley's day, you're on a very bare, almost like Samuel Beckett, like Spartan set. You know, they had no money. It's just two chairs, and it's black and white in its first years. And it's two men going back, and usually a man is his interlocutor, going back and forth, and it's a liberal, and Buckley's putting him in the firing line. He's a conservative who's going to challenge him, but also wants the listener to think Buckley himself has something to say and should be taken seriously. Well, how do we do that in normal life? We do it by being civil in the way we conduct ourselves. You know, you go to a dinner party, or you're meeting with friends, or you're at Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner. You don't want to be the guy who's shouting at everybody and, you know, be the crazy uncle. You don't want to be that person. You want to be the one who seems to listen to what other people say. So one of my discoveries all these years working on the book was what a great listener Buckley was. He would kind of cock his eye at you, and, you know, I'd be winking at the audience, but he's listening very closely. And he's going to listen to everything you say. Choose the word he's going to come back at you after, but the viewer knows Buckley really listened to what that other person said, whether it was Muhammad Ali or a Black Panther like Eldridge Cleaver, or whether it's President Reagan and President Nixon and all the other people he brought on the program.
Yeah, he had Muhammad Ali on while the New York Times was still describing him as Cassius Clay. So, I mean, he also had a young Jesse Jackson on. There are many African-American leaders at the time who were saying they were given – the only time they could be on television was on firing line with Bill Buckley.
The only time they were not being presented as a danger to the society, you know. You could see plenty of imagery of black militants, but Buckley invites – and I can tell that you've watched a lot of the YouTubes, and I recommend it to the audience because you go right on YouTube and watch them and watch Bill Buckley and Muhammad Ali. Just as you say, he states at the beginning, you will be Muhammad Ali on this program. That's the name you choose. That's the name we call you by. And half the program is a debate on the Nation of Islam with Muhammad Ali taking Elijah Muhammad's side and Buckley siding with Malcolm X, someone else he admired. For breaking away with the Nation of Islam. And you realize these are two serious men talking about serious things. And they're beautiful to look at. You know, don't get me wrong. They're very entertaining. Muhammad Ali is like a movie star times 10. And Buckley's very charming and handsome, too, and attractive. But they really have things to say to one another. It's fascinating.
Well, you've had access. You've done many interviews with Bill Buckley. You've had access to his private papers. Did he know that the cosmetic part of his argument was critically important?
Yes, he did. He did because the Buckleys, you're the first person I've said this to. The Buckleys as a family were kind of vain. You know, they're like the Kennedys, very handsome and attractive, and they knew that this is part of the appeal. Bill Buckley at Yale, some of the most interesting pages that if readers are interested in the book, will want to read about the young Buckley at Yale in the late 1940s, after his 2 years of service in the military, when he was part of that brilliant cohort, came in on the GI Bill. I say, you know, the one public program Buckley never objected to was the GI Bill, even though he didn't need it, because it meant he could spend the money on a car. But Buckley saw that he was outnumbered. And the only way when you're that badly outnumbered, you know, to win people to your side is to charm and persuade them, is to be someone other people want to spend time with. And Buckley had that quality. He was good company. And that's one reason people enjoyed the program so much. You know, a famous speechwriter who'd been at Yale with Buckley held him in complete awe, a guy named Ray Price, who wrote famous speeches for Richard Nixon, told me the most important thing Buckley did was to go in that program firing line every week. And the audiences, by the way, were not that large. It's not as if he was setting, you know, the Nielsen ratings afire. He was not. But it was what they called, and we now call boutique TV. It was appointment TV. And he said, and Ray Price said, Bill Buckley would go in that program every week. He's in the living rooms of Upper West Side liberals in Manhattan and New York. And they're thinking, OMG, this man is funnier than I am. He's wittier. He may be smarter, which also means maybe he's right. Right? Now, you didn't have to agree with him at all these things. You just had to have your mind that little bit open. So when the political culture, as we call it, shifted in the late 1960s, when a new militancy and radicalism entered the culture, one reason Buckley had Reverend Jackson and Muhammad Ali in his program, because he wanted people to hear what more we'll call the militant black thinkers and activists were like. Make the choice yourself. Buckley's not afraid to meet them. You listen to them and then think, well, do you want to go that way? Or do you want to go Buckley's way? It suddenly becomes more of an open, free-form question. And that's what was so key that he did those. And also running for mayor of New York at a very tense time. He was kind of an inverse Zoran Mamdani.
In other words, but Mamdani won.
Mamdani won. Mamdani coasted to victory, you know, the spring campaign.
Buckley came in a long third.
He did just well enough to keep the movement alive after Goldwater, as you said, had been so badly defeated.
And he was able to prove too that he was a energetic, electric media celebrity.
Well, and he was able to go out to California and meet with another of his many disciples, Ronald Reagan, and tell him, yeah, I think it is a good idea for you to run for governor in 1966. And that, and of course, that was the campaign, Reagan's, that really, not for president, even before then, when he ran for governor of California in 66, that turned the movement around. But Patrick Buchanan, a name some of your listeners will be familiar with, told me that in that period after Goldwater's defeat and before Nixon was elected president in 68 and Reagan in 1980, all the movement really had was Bill Buckley. He was the only person who was taken seriously. It didn't matter how badly he lost when he ran for mayor because he made a brilliant performance of it.
Yeah.
That's what led, by the way, to the Firing Line television program, was Buckley's brilliant performance in debates. Hilarious. Hilarious. They're funny. They're smart. He's able to take these very extreme
positions. I got to take a break here. So we're going to continue. I want to get into some of the big moments of Buckley, especially against Baldwin and Gore Vidal. That's coming up after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with Sam Tannenhouse. He's the author of the new biography of William F. Buckley Jr., Buckley, the Life and the Revolution That Changed America. You can call in with your questions and comments about William F. Buckley Jr., about conservatism, where has it been, where is it going, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Samir on the phones, and Samir, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, thank you for having me. I have kind of a question comment. So, William F. Buckley, as you mentioned, was very active in the 50s. McCarthyism was active back then. Ronald Reagan was a McCarthyist, as we know. He was also, I think, eventually became friends with Buckley as a mentor. I could be wrong about that, but Buckley was also friends with Milton Friedman. And I actually have, my background's in economics. So when I was a younger student, I used to look up to Milton Friedman. And then when I grew up, I realized a lot of his theories might have been wrong. But I feel like, because of Buckley's relationship with Reagan and Milton Friedman, Reagan was introduced to Milton Friedman's theories, which eventually kind of led to Reaganomics. And I was wondering if your author had any insight to that relationship between Buckley and Friedman and Reagan.
All right, Samir, thank you for that question. Sam, what about that connection?
Yeah, it's a very important connection. Buckley met Friedman, Milton Friedman, really through the Goldwater movement in 1964. You know, at the time when Goldwater got the nomination, Republican nomination, which Buckley and his brother-in-law, Brent Bozell, were instrumental in arranging. There's a lot on that in the story I tell. And I want viewers, the listeners to know, this book is a story. It is not an ideological attack or defense or anything else. It really is a narrative. And Milton Friedman was someone who was part of the circle brought in by Goldwater. What Buckley and Bozell and others, an influential conservative thinker, Russell Kirk, was also aware of, was that Goldwater had to have a kind of brain trust. He came from the Southwest, not Texas, but Arizona. Arizona hadn't even been a state, really, for all that long. They'd never had a really major politician. And Buckley saw in Goldwater someone he himself had some doubts about. Goldwater hadn't completed college. He was dynamic and charismatic, but there was no confidence that he had the kind of intellectual background he did. And so the people around Goldwater brought in advisors and intellectuals. All candidates do this. And Milton Friedman was one of the first. Buckley admired Capitalism and Freedom, which I'm sure the caller knows very well, probably knows it far better than I do, probably knows it better than Bill Buckley did. Bill Buckley knew a lot of what was in books without necessarily reading all that deeply in them. And Capitalism and Friedman and Freedom made the kind of libertarian argument that Buckley was very big on. Buckley came out of a libertarian background very much. A kind of almost laissez-faire view of the economy. And Friedman, as we know, was the most brilliant exponent of those theories. So Buckley got to know him, and this is typical of Buckley. He would go skiing every year with Milton Friedman and John Kenneth Galbraith, who is a liberal economist of the period. Why? Because they were both friends of Bill. And Bill wanted to make sure that Ken, on the one hand, and Milton, on the other, were on speaking terms, because that was important to him. He valued friendship very much. So he'd go skiing with, the three of them would go skiing together. And also, you bring Reagan in. Well, Buckley also knew that Reagan did not have the kind of background in economics that he wanted. You know, the fear was that Goldwater had been defeated in part because even though he had some intellectuals around him, it didn't seem as if he was really conversant with the ideas and arguments, and he himself said that. So he didn't have a college degree. Goldwater didn't think he was qualified to be president. Reagan brought more polish and sophistication, but Buckley wanted to be sure that he could really hold his own. I found an interesting document. This will interest the caller. From 1962 or three, a young disciple of Buckley's in California wanted to arrange a debate on economics. And he had Milton Friedman, Paul Douglas, Senator Paul Douglas from Illinois, who had been a college professor. And he said, should I put him up against Reagan? And Buckley said, no, you can't have Reagan do this. Douglas will kill him. He said, your man is Milton Friedman. And so that's where they all came together. And also when Buckley ran for mayor of New York in 1965, on a kind of libertarian platform, Friedman watched it very closely. And I found correspondence where Friedman would kind of scold Buckley, say, well, this program you're offering is too liberal. There's too much state involvement in the economy. We must preserve the autarkic economy. So there was a great deal of interplay between those three. Between those three, and it's kind of a highlight of American political life, especially conservative political life.
So you mentioned debates. Let's go to a debate that William Buckley Jr. had with James Baldwin. Basically a defining moment where, let's just give this a listen. Let's give a listen to this tape.
It comes as a great shock to discover that the country, which is your birthplace, has not in its whole system of reality evolved any place for you.
The fact that you lay the entire weight of the Negro ordeal on your own shoulders is irrelevant to the argument that we are here to discuss. The trouble in America where the Negro community is concerned is a very complicated one. What are your instructions that I'm to take back to the United States, my friend?
One thing you might do, Mr. Buckley, is let them vote in Mississippi.
I picked the cotton. And I carried it to market. And I built the railroads under someone else's whip for nothing. If one has got to prove one's title to the land, isn't 400 years enough? 400 years, at least three wars. The American soil is full of the corpses of my ancestors. Why is my freedom or my citizenship or my right to live there? How is it conceivably a question now?
And so Buckley arguing against the, you know, the expansion of the vote, protecting the vote for African-Americans in the South. He was against, he was in favor of segregation. And James Baldwin basically mopped the floor with him in that debate.
You know, as soon as Baldwin stood up and delivered that remarkable speech, what one of his biographers calls a sermon, and he's not saying that disparagingly. Baldwin was a brilliant a prodigy, a childhood
a preacher
or a preacher in the Pentecostal
church.
He was
on the pulpit as a child.
Yes, he was, and it's described in The Fire Next Time, which is really the book they're debating about. Buckley just had no idea what hit him, and he said, "Tonight is a lost cause." And he said, "Boy, you know, I'm losing this one badly." Yes, and that was an important lesson for Buckley because he thought he could put Baldwin in his place. And that was Buckley, the old Southern white guy, you know, because I said his father was from Texas, and which was segregated in those days. His mother was from New Orleans, segregated in those days. And the Buckleys also had a winter estate in Camden, South Carolina, about half an hour from Columbia, the state capital. That's one of the big discoveries I made researching his life, is the family had a segregationist history, not simply in supporting the white South, but actually owning and publishing a newspaper that that was sponsored the white citizens' councils of the time, which were called the Uptown Ku Klux Klan, you know, the respectable racists. The Buckleys were very much a part of that.
So that was the business interest that if anyone dared to open up their homes or their business to, you know, integration, that they would be ostracized.
Yes, the letter would come. Oh, we understand. Your neighbors have learned that you entertained a representative from the outside agitators at the NAACP, who in those days might be white as well as black, right? And as a result of which, you may have a little trouble getting a loan from our bank this year. That kind of economic pressure is very close to a kind of apartheid, you know, apartheid ideology. Buckley was a supporter of apartheid in South Africa, you know, for many years.
So how do you come back from that? How do you, you know, I mean, he was a great guy. They took care of their own people. You know, he was good in persons, but looking at the broader system of people, he was not on the right side.
Well, luckily for him and us, he changed his mind. You know, we've mentioned Reverend Jackson, whom I know a little bit, being on his program, and Black Panthers, but also other Black leaders and intellectuals. He had quite an impressive discussion right after Dr. King was assassinated, Martin Luther King, with Julian Bond, who is a very dynamic figure. And he and Buckley instantly hit it off. This was in 1968, the day after the assassination. And it's because Buckley could look you in the eye and take you on as a person. He was very egalitarian. And so what happened was, as his personal experience broadened, this happens to so many of us, right? As his personal experience broadened and he got to know more Black Americans, North and South, he began to rethink. So the same man who edited a magazine that in 1965, after the Voting Rights Act had been signed, published an article, not written by Buckley, but by one of his colleagues from South Carolina, James Jackson Kilpatrick, Virginia, sorry, had written a column he wrote often for National Review that said, and I'm quoting verbatim, "Should we give the Negro the vote?" This was respectable discourse in its day. Not that everybody agreed with it.
So he evolved. That's part of the story that you tell.
Yeah, and the answer to the question, by the way, was no, we should not give them a vote. Well, by 1970,
I got to take this break. All right, I'm going to get Jose and George on the air. And this is, and you want to call in 833-877-8255. Source continues after this. The Source is back, speaking with Sam Tannenhaus. His new book is Buckley, the Life and the Revolution That Changed America. I'm going to get these two callers on the air, Jose and George, and then I really want to get this tape in of Buckley with Gore Vidal, that famous tape. But first, let's go to Jose. Jose, you're on the air.
Hi, great show. I just wanted to share some thoughts here on Buckley. Buckley was, I enjoyed, as a New Yorker, I enjoyed reading and learning how to listen to Buckley. Because he did have I can never get his accent right. I didn't know where he was coming from. I didn't even think he was from South Texas. I thought he was from the UK or something like that. And then I come to learn that he was an American. Well, okay. The other thing I wanted to share was you guys touched on his debate with James Baldwin. The difference between Buckley and today's conservatives is that I think that after that debate, he became more empathetic. But it doesn't really mean much. But at least you could say that he was capable of changing and having more empathy towards Baldwin's positions. The other one thing I wanted to ask the author, and I'll leave it with that, is did you see any demonstrable change after the debate with Baldwin you say you mentioned his relationship, his openness to have Julian Bond and Jesse Jackson and so on. I'm pretty sure that it went even further than that. And it's unlike the modern day conservative that I see today. I see a contrast between Buckley's conservatism and the conservatism we see today.
All right, Jose, thank you for the question. So, Sam, did you see any change in Bill Buckley after that famous debate with James Baldwin?
Yes, I did. For one thing, there was a second debate that's not as well known. They had in New York. The first one was in Cambridge in England, February 1965. And the next one came in the spring in New York. And there, the two were both seated. It was on the David Susskind program. And it was very tough. They went after each other pretty hard. But you could see the mutual respect there. And the other thing that I want to mention, it's really important, so now we're talking about the mid-1960s. In 1970, Buckley wrote an article, Life magazine, that said America could use, I'm going to use the language of the day, so I don't want to trigger anybody, America could use a Negro president, a black president, that it would be good for the country, it would be good for black Americans to see one of their own. You know, it can sound a little condescending today, but really what he meant was it would be a good thing for America. And so someone who thought black people shouldn't even be allowed to vote.
He didn't think they were qualified. He didn't think they were capable of voting physically.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
Yeah,
I'm going to go to George. Right. I'm going to go to George on the phones. And George, you're on the air.
Yes, I read about something. I don't understand the neocons and the neoconservatives. But he was really, really influenced a lot by the neoconservatives, and it seems like they're mostly Russian, like the National Review and the Straussians and all those. They were kind of anti-middle class, kind of like Earl Butz was. They want to get rid of your small independent businessmen. I was just wondering if you could talk about how he got influenced by the neoconservatives.
All right, George, thank you for that. Well, the neoconservatives were famous for cheering on the war in Iraq, which is something that Buckley was opposed to. So I don't think he really fits into that neoconservative. He was actually the original conservative. But Sam, what's your take?
Well, I would say that the caller makes one important point, though. I mean, he makes several, but one that's really important, which is that early on when Buckley started National Review in 1955 at the age of 29, his mentors, a number of them were ex-communists and who had been absolutely enthralled to the Russian Revolution, to Soviet communism, and they changed their minds and went the other way, and that's what a lot of neoconservatism was. Or in later years, they were liberals who changed their minds. And so Buckley became kind of a gatekeeper who let them in. He thought they had enough to contribute that they could help, again, reach a broader audience. So he really recommended to Reagan that he speak with a number of these important neoconservatives. And they thought of Reagan, by the way, as being like them. Reagan had been a union guy. He'd been a Democrat, New Deal Democrat, who'd moved to the right. And Buckley saw that allies like that were very useful. But you're right, in the Iraq War, he really had his doubts and began to pull back from it.
I'm going to play the tape of the Gore Vidal Bill Buckley debates ABC during the 1968 big party conventions, Republican, then the Democrats. This is in, you know, Chicago. This is the big flare-up between the two. ABC was a struggling network. They couldn't challenge Chet Huntley and on NBC or the Murrow boys on CBS. So this is what they cooked up instead, having this debate during the political conventions. This is when things really got hot. Let's give a listen.
You must realize what some of the political issues are here. That many people in the United States happen to believe that the United States policy is wrong in Vietnam, and the Viet Cong are correct in wanting to organize their country in their own way politically. This happens to be pretty much the opinion of Western Europe and many other parts of the world. If it is a novelty in Chicago, that is too bad. But I assume that the point of the American democracy is you can express any point of view you want.
Shut up a minute.
No, I won't. And some people were proto-Nazi, and the answer is that they were well treated by people who ostracized them, and I'm for ostracizing people who egg on other people to shoot American Marines and American soldiers.
As far as I'm concerned, the only sort of pro- or crypto-Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that...
So earlier we were talking about how Bill Buckley mastered the cool media of television, and this in a turn red hot here. And he lost his footing. Tell us more, Sam.
Yes, that was one of the great embarrassments of Bill Buckley's life. And here it's important to point out, which you have very ingeniously helped us see, that the most famous debater of his time lost his two most famous debates, first to Jimmy Baldwin, as everyone called him, and second to Gore Vidal. Buckley and Vidal had not been adversaries really before then. People don't realize this because they became mortal enemies. I found correspondence where they addressed each other as Bill and Gore. Oh, Gore, can you come to this debate we're doing at Hunter College in New York? Oh, Bill, sorry, I'm busy, this kind of thing. But what happened was Vidal was one of many who were persuaded that Bill Buckley was a closeted gay man. And so what he did was to push Buckley's buttons all through those debates. There were a dozen of them. And this was the peak one, or the depth, that happened during the Chicago riots, right? The demonstration that happened during the Democratic Convention. But what I found when I went through all the debates is Vidal had been very cleverly pushing Buckley's buttons and getting under his skin. Buckley, remember, was used to having his own television program where he is the host, he's the moderator, he gets the first word and the last word. Not this time. He's just one of two guys. And he did not want to go up against Vidal. They had tangled once before publicly, and Buckley hadn't liked it. So when ABC News came to him and said, is there anybody you don't want to debate? He said, Gore Vidal, and then they knew they had their man. And it's funny because when you hear it now, you notice the same thing people did back then, which is these guys sound alike. You know, both these kind of upper crust, you know, Anglo-sounding guys. And yet their politics could not be more different. They were mirror images of each other is what I came to realize.
In your book, one thing I really thought was great that you put a lot of time into was the story of Edgar Smith, who was on death row in New Jersey for the brutal murder of a 15-year-old girl that he attempted to sexually assault, and how Bill Buckley defended him, thought that that Smith was innocent, and helped him be, getting out of prison. And then in 1976, he goes ahead and abducts and stabs another young woman. Similar circumstances. I mean, this was fascinating to me. And it just kind of showed how Bill Buckley, he kind of, you know, lost sight of things sometimes.
You know what he would do, David? He would convince himself. You know, great persuaders are self-persuaders. And he was taken in by a brilliant con man. Edgar Smith was very intelligent, he was a good writer, and he figured Buckley out pretty early when he began corresponding with him. Buckley had been put onto the case in 1962. It was a brutal murder, a notoriously brutal murder. He absolutely practically decapitated this 15-year-old girl when Smith himself was in his early 20s. The jury took 2 hours to convict him. He'd given a full confession. Then he decides, no, he's going to be a jailhouse lawyer. Claimed the confession was forced under the new Warren Court rules, the Miranda rights, yeah, and all the rest. Courts were looking again.
So we're running out of time here, but you know, it's just interesting that, and I think this is the fundamental, a seminal example of how Bill Buckley worked with the world and with the facts. But your book is fantastic. It takes me back to so many great moments of political history in the United States and conservatism. Conservatism, you know, a fundamental part of American political thought today. Sam Tannenhaus's book is Buckley, the Life and the Revolution That Changed America. Thank you so much.
Oh, what a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News.